Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. Trish Wood here, and you're listening to On the Fringe. We have a pretty interesting couple of hours for you today. Hour one is my old friend, Vanessa Beale. She's more of a social media friend, but I've interviewed her before. I admire her very much, and she's been to most of the places we're going to be talking about this hour, which is to say Palestinian places in the Middle East, in the middle of this conflict, which I don't know about you guys, but I'm having, I mean, beyond nightmares. And the nightmares aren't just that I'm actually watching the news organization showing footage, which is to say Channel 4 and Al Jazeera and Democracy Now, who sometimes I can't stand, have been terrific on this. I have a whole new love affair going with Amy Goodman on some of the stuff she's doing. So if you see what is happening there, unless you are a monster, you should be unsettled by it. And even more unsettling is the fact that people aren't, right? Like, I just saw Tony Blinken after this meeting with some of the Arab states about it, doing his thing about how much he cares about the children in Gaza, because he sees his own children when he sees the footage of dead babies being pulled out from the rubble. Well, if you see that, then why aren't you forcing Israel to do what they must do, which is cease fire, right? I mean, apparently there was some reporting, I think it was from CNN, and they're saying that the message to Netanyahu from Blinken is that there's going to be a very, very limited amount of time that this bombardment is going to be permitted in the minds of people. I think we're long past that, but that Netanyahu basically said no. So, I mean, why is Netanyahu pushing this guy around even? I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, the people running American foreign policy right now are, I mean, they're not serious people. That's the kindest way for me to put it. I say that on the show every week, but it's absolutely gobsmacking. What have we got? Ukraine disaster. Those of us who said it was going to be a disaster and that they should go for the peace agreement that Biden put the kibosh on. I mean, there was a, remember the flags in people's bios? You remember the, oh, we're not playing Tchaikovsky because of Putin. Oh, you can't possibly want a ceasefire. They got to fight till the last Ukrainian. No sane person actually believed those things. No one did. And those of us who said it, me and Colonel McGregor and all kinds of other people, were chastised for it. And now here we go again, same people. And when I say the same people, it was to a large degree the American State Department that got the Russia-Ukraine incident going. It goes back to 2014. They're just hopeless. And of course, let's not forget, back on Ukraine for a minute, that Biden had all of that dirty business going on in there. I believe that's true. I think only a really naive person or a fool thinks that he was not illegally compensated somehow through his son for what was happening in Ukraine. And whoops, all of a sudden they're all in on Ukraine and helping Zelensky, who seems like a nut, and shoveling money at them with no accountability. I mean, and now they're going to, you know, they're going to be the moral arbiter in between Israel and Gaza. I mean, this is, it's like living in clown world. You know, it's one thing when serious people get things wrong because they just got it wrong. And that happens in human life. No one is infallible. But these people they're kind of a weird combination of evil doing and stupidity and hubris and all the things that kind of make my skin crawl. So we're going to talk to Vanessa about all of that. And then hour two, we're going to do something a little bit different today. As you guys know, I am a recovering alcoholic. I talk about it a lot. I've got like 23 years in now. Pretty proud of that. It's a hard slog, but a much better way of living. And my son, Thomas Hayes, who is a writer, but primarily a drug and alcohol therapist and a really good one, also recovering from the same kind of addiction that Matthew Perry had. He's coming on for hour two, and we're going to talk about Matthew Perry, whose stepfather, Keith Morrison, I knew quite well. We worked together at CBC back in the day. And his mother, Suzanne Perry, was loosely related to my first husband. So my first husband was Matthew Perry's uncle by marriage for a minute and a half. I don't know these people well, so I'm not name dropping. And that actually has nothing to do with why I'm doing the show, except to say that he was a really nice guy. That's what everyone says. And they're a nice family and they're good people. So this is a tragedy. But the thing about Matthew Perry that we're going to talk about today, also in the context of Friends, which I could care less about, but my son grew up watching Friends. So he also kind of understands why everybody's head is exploding. But we're mostly going to talk about the addiction part of it, because there are these interesting people like Robert Downey Jr. It took him forever to get sober. Anthony Bourdain was never actually sober, right? He stopped shooting heroin, but kept drinking and smoking weed, and then had a bad outcome, committed suicide, right? I think because he was still acting like an addict, and lots of people agree. So we're going to talk about Matthew Perry and his addiction and why, in the context of recovery, it's frequently these really charismatic, interesting, and super smart people who just can't get sober, or it takes them like forever to get sober, like it did. Matthew Perry was doing like 100 Vicodin a day or some like really monstrous amount of pills. So he really struggled. I think he was sober at the end. We don't have the toxicology back yet about why he actually died alone, sadly, in that hot tub in his backyard of his very nice house. No wife, no kids. He was kind of a lonely guy, which goes sometimes with addiction too. So my son's coming on, and you'll meet him, and he's terribly smart and very sensitive about that stuff. So you might learn a few things. I usually do. So I want to get right to Vanessa, because we have a lot to talk about this hour with her. And I guess I'll start by asking Vanessa, what is your response to Tony Blinken's conversations about how he feels so badly for these kids that are being slaughtered in Gaza?
Well, for me, it's hi, Trish. It's good to be back on with you. And congratulations. Thanks. On the 23 years. I understand how difficult it is. I lived with someone that had addiction, so I know how hard it is. So really, congratulations to you on that. Amazing.
Thank you.
Look, you know, I put no store in these kind of emotional outpourings of basically what I consider to be psychopaths. I don't think they have any conscience. You know, they've watched now for 2 years. Well, no, since 2014, they've watched the ethnic cleansing basically in the eastern sectors of Ukraine by the extremist forces that they have empowered and expanded throughout Ukraine and used as a weapon, a battering ram against Russia. And you know, they have no conscience about the civilian deaths in Donbass on a daily basis, the use of cluster bombs. They have no conscience about the hundreds of thousands of Syrians that have died in the regime change war in Syria since 2011, or in Libya, or in Iraq, or in Yemen. So I really don't put any great, you know, trust in his sincerity. And what I find more telling is the fact that, you know, Blinken visited Israel on the day that Syed Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, made his speech. And almost immediately after the speech, the massacre started. So you can't, you know, I just don't believe that this is all Netanyahu. They're probably setting him up as a fool guy, for sure, because, I mean, Netanyahu is equally unhinged. I mean, we can talk about that in a bit as well, and his connections to revisionist Zionism and revisionist Zionism connection to Nazism in Ukraine. You know, so it's very clear where his ideology is coming from, and it has nothing to do with Judaism, of course, as for the large part, Zionism has no connection to Judaism either. I mean, when it was created in the 1880s onwards, even then Jewish communities were describing it as an anti-Semitic cult that they thought would just disappear like so many others, right? But clearly it hasn't. Why? Because of course it was empowered as a British land grab colonialist project in Palestine, and then it was picked up by the US. So equally, I don't think the US has any great sympathy for Israelis, by the way. I think they perceive Israel as basically their military outpost in the region and just an instrument for US foreign policy. And in all honesty, you know, it was clear when the events happened on the 7th of October, and almost immediately Israel came to the defense of Israel and sent aircraft carriers, troop carriers, etc., followed by the UK, followed by France, followed by Germany.
Yeah.
This isn't about, you know, the defense of Israel. This is about the defense of their interests, because they know that alone Israel can't actually deal with Hezbollah and regional resistance parties. It can't. So they're defending their interests in the region. That's the bottom line for me. And, you know, every day has just been a new massacre. And as you said, this is no longer about, how can I describe this? You know, if we're not reacting to that in a visceral fashion as human beings, regardless of the politics, we failed as humanity. And I've seen multiple people saying this now in from various factions across the world, saying, you know, we have really failed if we now have to go on million men marches to stop bombing children. We're in the 21st century.
Yeah, I have found, even in my own following from my other podcast and the Substack that I do, that I'm seeing something I'm quite uncomfortable with. And that is that one guy even wrote in a comment, he said, war is terrible. It's very bourgeoisie to worry about, you know, it's ugly. We don't, you know, this is what happened. We drop bombs on Dresden, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. So, you know, and that's it. That argument, which is quite an academic one in a sense, is so removed from what's actually happening in Gaza. I have to think, and I do think part of me could be convinced that this is true, that the people who are doing these asinine things on social media, like saying, well, children are dying because Hamas is using them as human shields, you know, tell Hamas to, you know, turn themselves in, and then the children won't have to die. And I'm like, what? Do you understand how ridiculous that logic is, right? I think that those people, well, there's a lot of Israeli bots from their, huge propaganda. What is it? Harabas? Is that what it's called? Harabas?
Hezbollah.
Yeah, Hezbollah. Thank you. So clearly a lot of them are setups, right? But I also believe that maybe the people saying those things aren't seeing on the news they watch what I am seeing when I'm watching Channel 4 and Al Jazeera and the other stuff that I knew CNN and all those were going to be like a write-off. So I did seek out people who had people in Al Jazeera had reporters. Most of them have been killed, but they had reporters, you know, in Gaza. And I'm actually seeing the carnage. And I wonder if people, just because the news is so corrupt right now, they aren't seeing what's happening to the children. There was literally a stack of children yesterday, videotaped stack of dead children being wrapped up and taken away. And I thought, how can you possibly defend this?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, extraordinary how many people picked up and ran with the IDF excuse that Hamas were in the ambulances that they targeted. You know, for people to understand, these ambulances had been cleared by the Red Cross at Rafah, which is the border with Egypt, to leave the Gaza Strip safely and to be evacuated for medical care. So these were already wounded and you know, badly suffering patients families, whole families, who were told that they could be evacuated safely to the south and taken out through the Rafah crossing for hospital treatment. And these were the ambulances that were bombed and the gatherings outside four hospitals. You know, I mean, it doesn't even seem enough to call this a war crime anymore. This is just complete genocidal mania that's going on. And I've been in Gaza. I was in Gaza in 2012. I entered through the tunnels. And 3 days after I entered, the aggression, the Israeli aggression of 2012 started. And of course, even before it started, they assassinated a leader of Hamas in the street. They fired on funeral goers at the edge of the Gaza Strip. They killed in front of us. We were in the southern area of Khan Yunis just reporting on an Israeli incursion into Gazan territory, farmland. And in front of us, a 13-year-old boy was killed by an Israeli helicopter just for playing football outside his home. So this is a daily occurrence, even outside of official wartime. This, even in ceasefire, this is a regular occurrence. I've been in Gaza when literally a guy on his motorbike going to work is just blown up by a drone. And this is peacetime. You know, fishermen are fired on a daily basis. I used to wake up every morning at 5 a.m. to the sound of machine gun fire because the Navy would be firing on the little kind of tiny little wooden fishing boats that, by the way, they've bombed them all today. So that entire recourse of fishing and finding some kind of food has also been knocked out. They've been hitting all manner of infrastructure today to completely plunge Gaza into darkness and an inability to survive. Hospitals are conducting operations with no anesthetic. I mean, there's videos of children being operated on, not minor operations, with no anesthetic. Doctors are putting out videos saying they're using vinegar to clean wounds because they just don't have any medicines left, you know? I mean, it's hell on earth. And then to try and justify it with this insane idea that it's all Hamas. You know, as I said, I was in Gaza in 2012 under the Israeli bombing. And it's not only bombing from warplanes. It's from Navy off the coast that will fire on the refugee camps that are right on the coast. It's like an absolute cacophony of war. I mean, I've been to front lines in Syria. I have never experienced anything like an Israeli bombing of Gaza. And now in 2023, it's off the scale. It's not even something I can imagine, having lived through an aggression in 2012. And to say that Hamas are using civilians as human shields is insane. And it's also, by the way, been absolutely debunked even by the likes of the BBC and CNN. There are multiple reports saying that there is no evidence to back up this claim. But there is evidence that the IOF forces have regularly used, particularly children, as human shields, particularly in the occupied territories and in the West Bank. And of course, they summarily execute children anyway on a regular basis and are doing so. But in an area that, which is the Gaza Strip, which is 40 kilometers by 12 kilometers, surrounded on all sides by barbed wire, or apartheid walls with gun turrets, with Zionist tanks and Zionist soldiers surrounding the entire area. As I said, the fishermen can only go out fishing to a certain line in the Gazan water before they're fired on. They can't escape via Rafah border. This is a huge complex. I've entered through the border itself. You effectively enter the Rafah crossing border, which is under Egyptian control. You then have a buffer zone, which you have to cross in a bus, because if you try to cross by foot, you'll be shot, because the buffer zone is also under the control of the Israelis. Like, many people don't understand these details.
No, but they don't. They don't understand.
Is using civilians. Yeah. The Hamas is using them as human shields. You have 2.2 million people in a strip of land. I mean, I can't think of an equivalent in the US, for example, but in the UK, the Isle of Wight, it's tiny. 2.2 million people. They don't have shelters. They don't have bunkers. They don't have places they can go to for safety. And now you have 2.2 million people, however many thousands have been killed among that or injured, that have been evacuated, forcibly evacuated from the north to the south. So you have half the landmass with double the amount of people that is being bombed. They were supposed to reach safe areas in the south. Israel basically bombed the convoys from the north to the south and then bombed the refugee centers that have gathered outside schools and hospitals. I mean, it's just carnage on a scale that really we haven't seen, I haven't seen. I know, of course, if you look at the bombing of Iraq in 2003, Yugoslavia in 99, of course, we've seen some, let's say, comparative bombing campaigns, but not in what is effectively a concentration camp.
Yeah, you know, and the density.
They've got nowhere to go.
I mean, I saw this, know it's and the density of it, right? We're going to go to a break, but I wanted to say I saw this. I've been watching a lot of stuff on YouTube, and they were interviewing Norman Finkelstein, a couple of people, and they were, you know, on a different side, and the thing that was interesting was that the people who aren't seeing it are grabbing at any straw. So here was the argument: he said 9,000 dead, or whatever the current number is. And if you check that, the UN accepts it, the Red Crescent accepts it. Most of the numbers actually even have names attached, which I only found out a couple of days ago. So they're reasonably solid and nobody sane disputes them, except people who are blindly supporting the bombing. And this guy said, this is how illogical they are. He said, well, it's such a dense area, given the amount of bombing, you know, we can't trust the numbers. The numbers should actually be higher, shouldn't they? And then he realized what he'd said. Like he was arguing, right? He was arguing against it. I mean, it was, but he still didn't kind of realize what he'd done. Anyway, I want to talk to you about, did you see the interview with Mads Gilbert on Democracy Now? Did you see that?
I haven't seen it, but I think Mads Gilbert was, and I think I did meet him fleetingly in 2012 in Gaza.
He said some.
He was back there in 2014. Yeah.
Yeah, he said some really interesting. He's an amazing guy, and he said some really interesting things that I want to just talk to a little bit about. He was kind of speculating about what it's like on the ground there right now, which no one's really doing. So let's, this is Trish with TNT Radio. I'm here with the brave and brilliant Vanessa Abili, taking apart this episode in history that is so huge it's almost breathtaking, and some people get that and other people don't, and that makes it even worse. Anyway, back in a moment.
You should hear what Lynn Shaw is talking about.
Your kids, our youth, are seeing the worst of humanity because if they have unlimited, unfiltered, unmonitored access to the internet, this is what they are seeing. This is the truth. So I urge all of you, think about all of this. Take actions. Think about what you can control in your own home, in your environment, in your community. When I have somebody say to me, a parent, I don't want to open that can of worms. It's going to lead them into doing, asking more questions or looking at porn. Let me tell you something. These kids are smart. These kids are savvy. They are already seeing it, hearing about it. And even if you do everything correctly, I am here to tell you, their friends will show them something. So we want to empower. It's not just no, 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 you can't do this. Talking to them, here's how we're all staying safe. Here is how we're going to put our devices down, I don't know, every day for 15 minutes. That is up to you. You have parental autonomy.
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio.
The Lights is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
All aboard! don't think you're the one losing your mind.
And I don't know how many commercials you'll see. 3 out of 5 have mixed race couples in them. That's not by accident. They're selling soap, man.
We can't believe it, but we cover it.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, it's Trisha Wood here back with Jennifer Beley, and we're talking about the dark days that have descended, not just over Israel and Gaza, but over the whole world. I mean, there's a lot of people who should be speaking out who aren't. The people who are speaking out are being smeared. And this, I really believe, as happened after Rwanda, where I reported from, not during the genocide, but just, we were there like 5 minutes after it happened. There were still bullet holes in our hotel window, and everybody was so traumatized. It was like kind of a zombie movie. I mean, it's really awful. And nobody really spoke out there either. It kind of happened before anybody really talked about it. So I think in a year or so from now, sadly, like Ukraine and these other foreign policy disasters, that people will be saying, well, what did that happen? And what was everybody doing? And what were you thinking and tweeting? And then, of course, it's too late by then. And we can't keep doing this. We can't keep doing it. Anyway, I want to talk about, if you want to see something interesting, go to YouTube, pull up Democracy Now!, look for the two-part interview she did with Mads Gilbert, who is a Norwegian, as I understand, or a Swedish, can't remember which, Scandinavian surgeon who has been working, living and working in Gaza for like 20 years. He's also a prof at some university in Europe too, but he was stuck in Cairo wanting to get in. And he said a couple of interesting things. He said, first of all, he is prepared to go back there and die in service of the Palestinian people in Gaza, which I think is extraordinary. And I understand why he feels that way. I mean, a lot of good people feel the need to take a stand right now and stand with them. But then he kind of broke down what happens after this sort of bombardment and the days ticking by. And there's no water, so they're drinking brackish water, right? There will be no antiseptic, so there will be massive infections raging. And he said already the doctors are getting fevers and not feeling well, and there's going to be all kinds of stuff like cholera and all kinds of stuff going around about cleanliness and things that can happen under those circumstances. But this was the thing that chilled me to the bone, amongst many things he said that were upsetting. And that was that there are a lot of bodies in that rubble still, and they're never getting it out. There's no diggers. They're all doing it with their hands, right? And those bodies are going to decompose, and let's just not even talk about how awful that smell is going to be. Let's just talk about the sanitation issue that comes with that. So there's going to be raw sewage, there's going to be massive infections, there's no clean water, there's decomposing bodies, and all of this stuff is happening right on top of a whole bunch of traumatized people, many of whom are wounded and injured and burned and dying without proper care. I mean, this is a Wagnerian fourth ring of hell. And for me, for a guy like Blinken to get up and pretend to care when he is the cause of this is absolutely, it's mind-blowing for me. I mean, I can't actually even believe it's happening. But that interview with Mads Gilbert is findable, and you should watch it on YouTube. Back to Vanessa. Does that just about sum up what they're going to find there, Vanessa, in about 3 or 4 days more?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also worth pointing out that, you know, regularly what Israel does is to destroy the infrastructure, which includes any kind of water pumping station. So, of course, actually Gaza, when it rains, it just becomes, I can't think of a better term, but a river of sewage, because there's no way of either purifying the wastewater, because they destroy the processing plants, they destroyed the desalination plant, so they can't use seawater as drinking water. So they're literally drinking heavily polluted seawater. It's not only brackish, it's polluted because of this inability to actually evacuate sewage from Gaza. And as I said, in the winter, and we're coming into, you know, the rainy months, so you can imagine that's going to compound the issue even more, because then you've got, I don't know, you know, tons and tons of rubble with bodies underneath, and then you're going to get the rains. And so therefore all of this toxicity is going to be washed out into the streets, including, as I said before, sewage. And again, you've got now 2.2 million in half the acreage that they were in before. So if you like, the situation has been compounded and made 10 times worse. And I think also what Madge Gilbert said, you know, in answer to this idea that they were bombing the hospitals because Hamas had headquarters in the hospitals, he said, you know, this is complete nonsense. If that had been the case, I wouldn't be working in Shifa Hospital, which is one of the biggest. I mean, he worked in all the hospitals around the Strip, but I mean, Shifa Hospital is probably the main hospital in central Gaza, and that's been not directly bombed, but what they're doing is bombing around it. So they're bombing the thousands of refugees that have gathered around the hospitals, both for treatment and for shelter. They're bombing the UNRWA schools, including, and this is another point that was actually made by Euromed Monitor, and it said that people that are digging, as you rightly said, with their hands and with very rudimentary tools, because again, the civil defense has been bombed. The various kind of Red Cross civil defense organizations that could be coming to help with heavy equipment of some kind to dig through the rubble have been targeted and destroyed. And so people are literally, there was a video 2 days ago of a man which just broke my heart, with a kind of mallet in his hand, trying to find the bodies of his four children under what appeared to be just a landscape of rubble. I mean, it's just not possible he's going to ever find them. And what Euromed Monitor said, not only this, but people who are trying to dig through the rubble or are bringing bodies out of the rubble are getting cuts and burns on their hands. And they are saying this is from chemical weapon use by the Israelis. So they're dropping white phosphorus. This is what white phosphorus will do in low quantities. When it gets onto your body, it burns through your skin. If a white phosphorus bomb lands close to children, it'll take the flesh off their bones. And this is being used liberally. As for 2 days ago in the UNRWA school, there's a video of them dropping white phosphorus into a school where there are hundreds of kids taking shelter, an UNRWA school. UNRWA staff have been killed. I think we're up to about 25 now.
Yeah.
It's the largest number of UN UNRWA staff in any conflict that has been killed in this conflict. Paramedics, you mentioned journalists. I mean, every day we're hearing about journalists being killed, and there was I was just in tears. I can't remember which channel he's with. It might be one of the Arabic ones. And he just started taking off his helmet and his flak vest. He just lost his friend.
I saw it.
The bombing. Yeah. And he just said, what's the point? Like, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. I know from my experience, we were driving around in a press car. We were getting targeted by drones. Yeah. Even when we went with the ambulances were being targeted. There is literally no safe place.
Yeah.
And there is, you know, and what gets me, Blinken and bipartisan Congress people are just putting out messages that this is all okay. They're normalizing genocide.
Yeah. Yeah. That guy with taking off the flak vest and the helmet, he was doing a live shot, right? And he was talking to the anchor, and he was doing a live shot. He took it off. He's like, what's the point? You're right. Like, I too was crying watching it as a, you know, former journalist.
Yeah. Well, she was crying. The anchor was crying. I mean,
she was sobbing.
Yeah.
I know. It was a very symbolic move, I thought, and it kind of summed up. Well, do you know what the number 35? Am I right about that? That 35 journalists have been killed? It's like, what, Israel is a rogue state at this point. I just am not. All the rules are gone. Every rule
but
is gone.
It's being normalized by the US and the UK and the EU. This is what is terrifying. So our governments are basically saying, well, there are no rules, and you can exterminate an entire people. And by the way, I mean, there's at least one Israeli intelligence document. There's one think tank document actually talking quite blatantly about basically ethnically cleansing the Palestinians in Gaza into the Sinai. They've set up a whole plan and strategy for it to relocate them to Egypt, to put in a 7 kilometer wide sterile zone, as they call it, to prevent them coming back to Palestine. I think it's the Arab language, Israeli, I don't know if it's a website or the account on X, as it now is, I can't get used to that, put out an image of, yeah, of the map of Palestine, just entirely Israel. So it's very clear, and what is worrying me is that this is being normalized, it's just being accepted as the norm under the rules-based order. You know, in the West, that, yeah, it's fine if our proxy in the Middle East commits genocide. It's fine. We've been doing it for 75 years anyway. Let's get, and you remember right at the beginning, was it Biden who said, let's finish them?
Oh, I don't know, was it? I wouldn't
be
surprised.
Yeah, he actually, he used this kind of terminology. And I just wanted to add, along with Mads Gilbert, in 2014 and 12, there was a French surgeon whose name escapes me, but he was also working in the hospitals. When he came back to France and he was lecturing at one of the universities in Paris, he used photos from the Israeli aggression on Gaza, and he was then promptly taken to court. He was prosecuted for anti-Semitism because he was using images from Gaza of wounds from various hideous types of bomb to demonstrate some, you know, his surgical class what they needed to do in these kind of injuries, and he was taken to court for anti-Semitism. Equally, there's a British doctor, British Palestinian Hassan Abu Sitta, who's now in Gaza. He's on Twitter and he's being interviewed quite regularly. But the British police are harassing his family under the Terrorist Act, because apparently he's also helping Hamas. So they're interviewing his family, harassing his family, while he is saving lives in Gaza. I mean, it's just like a complete inversion of what humanity should be, right?
No, I mean, it is. And for those of us who see it, I'm not saying to make myself a victim here at all. It's not who I am. but it's for those of us who see it, it's really, really difficult, because you start existing in another world, don't you? I mean, it's really really weird. It's really weird.
Yeah, I do, and it's actually very it's very internally disturbing to realize that you are operating in a completely other dimension to many of the people that you're talking to about this. Even if they have the best intentions, it's almost like a right at the beginning on October the 7th, and most of the so-called atrocities committed by Hamas have now been completely debunked and discredited anyway, and it turns out that Israel fired on its own civilians. Israel used its civilians as human shields when it was firing on the resistance factions, right? And then when the hostages were taken into the buildings close to the Gaza Strip, after 2 days, Israel bombed them by tank and by helicopter. So, you know, Israel was responsible for a huge number of the deaths on the 7th of October. And of course, everybody rushed to judgment, you know, the beheaded babies, the rapes, the this, the that, the other. And I remember doing an interview on the day, and he's a really good guy, but even he was a bit kind of hair in headlights with me. And I said, listen, shouldn't we remember that every time we rush to judgment, we're proven wrong? So why are we doing it again right now? You know,
well, look,
of course they're going to say this is their justification for bombing, right? So of course these stories are going to start coming out.
Well, and
seriously, baby, come on.
They come out whenever Israel starts losing the argument. There's another atrocity. I think some things did happen, but I will also tell you, I will say this, that I worked hard debunking the beheaded baby story, because, and I'll tell you why I knew it was a problem. Because first of all, who it came from, it was a general who was a person who normally, he was a settler in real life and apparently quite a vicious one, and was causing trouble, right? So this is a guy who would not, who had an agenda about not telling the truth about this. And then it came from a single reporter. Nobody could ever, there's no, nothing. It just, every person who says it's true, it goes back to that news report and that guy. And even the White House backed away from it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And the problem for me with the beheading story was that they used the word beheading. Now, we know that if, for instance, those children were in a house where a shell hit, those shells can decapitate people, right? That there's something about the pressure in the room that rips your head off, right? So maybe that happened, maybe there were decapitated babies, but if that's true, and there are no pictures of them still, as I understand it, why would they use the word beheading? They did it because they wanted to connect the Palestinian people to the ISIS beheading videos. Mm-hmm. That's what happened there. There's no doubt about it in my mind, right? So Hamas is ISIS, and the Palestinians in Gaza voted in Hamas, so they're all ISIS, and therefore we're going to bomb. That's what happened there. But I will tell you that, and then there was also the, what was the other? There was another big the latest one was the baby in the oven that happened. As I understand that, IDF even walked that back. They even said no. But all of these things, they come out on a day when things are not going well. And what troubles me about it is, because I debunked the beheaded baby story in my Substack as much as I could. I mean, maybe it happened. I was there. I know, but I told why I didn't think so, and that atrocity propaganda is actually a thing. People were so mad at me. Oh, Vanessa, it was as if, you know, it was as if I was waving an ISIS flag or something. Anyway, let's take a break. I want to talk about why you think this happened and where you think it's going, because there's a lot of talk about what went wrong on October the 7th, and I think that's really important. So I'd like your thoughts on that. Anyway, this is Trish Wood, TNT Radio. We'll be back in a minute more with Vanessa Beely.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Kids say the darndest things and do them. One handful of young scamps dressed up as Joe Biden and his Secret Service detail for Halloween this week, and their antics have taken the internet by storm. Stumbling around, falling to the ground, going up to women and sniffing them. Our young protagonist was constantly guided which way to go, helped back to his feet, and pulled off unsuspecting females, as true Secret Service agents are tasked every single day. They say that politics is downstream of culture, and if you've lost the kids, you've pretty much lost your mojo, Joe. Meanwhile, at rallies across the country, crowds are packing in shoulder to shoulder for Donald Trump, including at the University of Mississippi, where platinum rapper Lil Pump led the crowd in a "We Want Trump" chant. Democrats know they've lost the youth vote, and they know that their prospects for 2024 aren't too good, which is why they're manicking in a panic to keep Donald Trump off the ballot. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Need a ride? Yeah!
Driving with kids is a big responsibility.
Hop in and buckle up!
So don't sweat the small stuff.
You got paint all over our paper!
Get the big stuff right instead.
What does that mean?
Like making sure your kids are in the correct car seat and buckled up for safer travel.
That deserves a wiggly wiggly wig.
To make sure your child is in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Beep, beep.
Yeah. Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, I am back with Vanessa Beely. We were talking a minute ago about the idea that there has been a long-held plan by Netanyahu specifically to drive the Gazans out of Gaza and into the Sinai. And there's quite a good piece written about that in Declassified UK by a guy named Jonathan Cook. And I interviewed Scott Horton yesterday on my other show. And he also has a version of that is being posted, I believe, on antiwar.com. They're really smart people over there too. Yeah. So some of this was, my intuition, Vanessa, tells me they just want to get them out. They want to just, what was the expression from Vietnam? Bomb them back into the Stone Age and then get rid of them and mm-hmm. grab that land. That's my sense of it. What do you think?
Well, no, I mean, I agree with you. There are theories abounding, predominantly, I must say, from Western analysts, certainly not from any analysts in the region.
Yeah.
And I'm in touch with quite a lot of them that, you know, there is a history. Hamas has a history of colluding with the Zionist government in the occupied territories. And historically, yes, there was some degree of collusion. And so therefore, there is this theory that this is basically a collaboration between Israel and Hamas to basically ensure the extermination of all Palestinians and to drive them out of the remaining Palestinian territories. Now, there's a few aspects to this that I need, I think, to clarify. First of all, in the last 2 or 3 years, in fact, probably from 2017 onwards, there has been a huge campaign by the resistance axis, including Iran and Syria. And of course, Syria suffered at the hands of Hamas during the regime change war, which started in 2011. And yet, even Syria has now normalized with Hamas in order to unify the resistance factions, both in Palestine and externally in the regional countries that support Palestinian freedom, basically, from apartheid and from brutal occupation. And so therefore, for me, the Hamas of today is not the Hamas of even 2 years ago. And of course, the operations were led not by the Hamas political wing, but by the Qassam Brigades, which is the military wing of Hamas, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Brigades, both of which had, I met both brigades when I was in Gaza in 2012, and their steadfastness against Zionist occupation was very clear back then, and of course now it's even more clear after this operation. So I tend towards the belief that this was a genuine operation. The reason they called it Al-Aqsa Flood was, I think, 3 days before the operation. Again, Israeli settlers had stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque under the protection of the security forces, the Zionist security forces. And of course, you know, the kind of the end time prophecy is that it basically means that Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is, I think, the third most holy site in the Muslim world, would have to be destroyed in order to enable the building of Temple Mount, right? This is according, I'm not a big kind of Bible reader or follower of prophecies, but there is this prophecy of Armageddon, and for the Zionists and for the evangelical Christians who were largely responsible for the creation of the State of Israel and the handing over and dispossessing of Palestinians and handing of land to the Zionist settlers, which, by the way, are considered by many, many Jews that I know to be really anti-Semitic, not connected to Judaism at all. And in fact, Orthodox Jews don't even believe that they should be occupying Palestinian territory from a religious interpretation perspective. So this is another thing that's often not talked about. So for me, this was the driver of this operation, and that was why it was called Al-Aqsa Flood. Now, initially, I think what they hoped to achieve was to take hostages, because, of course, historically, this has been the way that they get Israel to negotiate. Of course, what we've been seeing is that Israel really doesn't give a SH1T about its hostages, and it's quite happy to bomb them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even according to hostage testimony, right? Even according to those that were released and who talked about the humane way they were treated by their captors in the resistance factions. But coming back to Hamas, you know, Hamas is not the only resistance faction. There are 17 resistance factions alone in Gaza. There's multiple others in the occupied territories, in West Bank, in Jenin, in Nablus. And by the way, Hamas isn't in Jenin and Nablus, and yet we're seeing bombing in Jenin, we're seeing executions, we're seeing torture, which is being recorded even by organizations like Euromed Monitor, right?
There's some videos I've seen.
No Hamas. Yeah. There's no Hamas in West Bank. So what's their excuse there? Right. So, you know, when you start taking it all apart, it makes some nonsense of what they're saying. And that basically, yes, this is all about extermination and ethnic cleansing again. It's people talk about it being Nakba 2, which was the catastrophe, it translates as, of 1948, which came after the 1947 UN partitioning of Palestinian territory and giving 50% to the Zionists, even though pre-1947 they only owned about 7% of the land. So, you know, the injustice started even before 1948. It started under the British Mandate and then continued until the Nakba in 1948, when 13,000 at least Palestinians were massacred, 750,000 to 1 million, depending on what literature you read, were expelled and don't have the right to return to their land. I mean, this is extraordinary. You know, Jews have the inalienable right to come to Israel to settle and to steal Palestinian territory again. But Palestinians, whose territory it was in the first place, are not allowed to come back. You know, the injustice is on so many layers that you would spend an entire night trying to go through them all to work out, you know, quite why. You know, Vasily Nebenzia in the UN made the point that Israel doesn't have the right to self-defense. Why? Because those territories, Gaza and East Jerusalem and West Bank, were effectively illegally annexed in the 1967 Six-Day War. So they don't have a right to self-defense because they're an illegal occupying force, and that is recognized even by the UN. So he's right in what he says. Yet the resistance, the Palestinian resistance, has every right to violently oppose a brutal occupying force. That's under international law. And yet we're having it spun so that it's completely inverted, right? They become terrorists as resistance. They become terrorists. Israel, that, by the way, backed and funded and armed and provided hospital treatment for Al-Qaeda in Syria, who really did burn people in 2013 in Adra, close to Damascus, in bread furnaces. They threw living civilians into the bread furnaces. Those are the groups that Israel is supporting inside Syria.
Yeah.
But when it's a resistance against Israel, they become terrorists. You know, this is the thing. It gets spun and it gets distorted out of all reality.
Well, what I think happens, especially based on everything you just said, I've been reading about in the literature about how it is perceived, and does Israel actually do have this right to defend itself? Now, people may say morally, given what happened, they do. But in international law, it is being debated about whether or not they have this right that America is so invested in supporting, no matter what. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. But I'm wondering, at the end of the day, Vanessa, in your view, do you think that they'll just be gone one day? I mean, what do you think the final outcome? And also, no one is going to be safer as a result of this, right? It's not going to help Israel's security at all. And I know that there are a lot of Jewish people saying that too, and they are horrified and saying, please don't do this in our name because we're not interested in it. But there doesn't seem to be, no one's saying what this is in aid of. They're saying, oh, wait, they have to remove Hamas. Well, what does that mean? Like, what does that look like? Do you remove all the Palestinians to get rid of Hamas? Yeah. Do you flatten it? Do you force them out? Do you kill them all? And then what? Because then are the other Arab countries in the region going to rise up? Is Hezbollah going to go nuts? I just don't see that there's an end to this. And we've got about a minute and a half left. So please do respond to that. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what we're seeing is the U.S. cartel yet again pushing for escalation. And in my opinion, of course, Iran is one of the targets for them. But also Syria, which is, you know, still occupied, still a target, still being basically, you know, attempted to turn it into a failed state. But, you know, I think even for, as you rightly said, there are many Jews that are really starting to kind of feel, well, you know, we don't agree with this. We don't actually want to be a part of this. And if you go back to pre the start of the Zionist movement, you had Mizrahim Jews, you had the Sephardic Jews, you had the Orthodox Jews living peacefully in the Middle East with Muslims, side by side with Christians in Palestine. And I think ultimately the only solution, I don't know quite yet how we get there, is a one state, a Palestinian state, where Jews, Christians and Muslims live together in equality and in democracy, and the dismantlement of the Zionist
settlement
state.
Yes. Wow, Vanessa, thank you so much. I could have had you for 2 hours, but I'll have you back while this is ongoing because it's really interesting hear from you. I'm grateful you did it. Thank you so much. This is TNT Radio. I'm Trish Wood. Back in a few minutes.